Okay, colleagues, members of the public, I'm calling to order this February 18th, 2015 meeting of the Senate Workforce Committee. Welcome you all. We have a lot of things on our agenda, and they are listed in a very logical order. However, we are going to not be following that order for logistical reasons. So we will, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 414 and hear some introductory remarks from Dr. Lafer and then Senator Roblin, who is going to introduce the bill. Then we're going to move on to Senate Bill 128 and Senate Bill 288, and then we'll go back to the contracting issue. Okay. All right, so I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 414. Gordon, could you come forward? Thank you. And while he's doing that, Matt, could you tell us what this measure does?
Sure. Senate Bill 414 permits employees of state agencies or representatives of state employees' bargaining units to seek judicial review of a contracting agency's cost analysis in certain circumstances. Establishes jurisdiction of judicial review, requires a contracting agency to halt procurement while under review, except when compelling interest or emergency is expressed in writing and supported by substantial evidence. The measure outlines judicial authority during review, prohibits award of cost or attorney's fees, provides additional steps to the procurement process, and declares emergency effective on passage. There is no revenue impact, and there's yet to be, it may have a fiscal impact, but no statement yet.
Okay. Thank you, Matt. Okay, Gordon, welcome. And you have a PowerPoint?
I do.
Yes.
And I'm not.
I think Carrie will set it up for you. Thank you. And as I understand, Sandy, Dr. Lipper, you're going to give us some background on public contracting?
That's right, yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members
yes.
of the committee for the invitation to participate in this. My name is Gordon Lafer. I'm a professor at the U of O. And over the past decade, I've engaged in a number of different studies of the economics of contracting out of public services in Oregon. Most of what I want to tell you about today relates to the case of relates to the case of the Central Point School District's decision to contract out school transportation to the First Student Company. Before I show you the findings from this that may be relevant to legislation, I just want to let you know two things. One is I have not been paid a cent in my pocket for any of this work. I get one salary, which is from the generous taxpayers of Oregon. I have not made any money from any of this, so I have no financial incentive one way or the other on this. The second thing is a team of us at the U of O spent about a year doing forensic accounting. We had a CPA working with us to understand the contract at Central Point. When that was done, when the report was done and before it was published, I sent it to the Central Point School District officials. They shared it with their consultant who also worked for First Student. They asked for 6 weeks, and I asked them to please let me know if there was anything that was factually incorrect in the report. They looked at it for 6 weeks, and they didn't identify a single fact that they said was factually wrong. So let me just talk a bit about the key issues here. And to give you some of the punchline up front, some of the things that emerge from how is ORS 279B being implemented and interpreted in practice, I think there are a few issues that I want to highlight. One is the importance of including all costs, both state as well as district monies, and sometimes cost-benefit analyses are done only counting local agencies' money and not counting the state's money. A second is make sure that you have the full information needed for the analysis. The current law says that before contracting out can happen, agencies have to show first that there will be a net fiscal benefit to taxpayers, and second that that benefit won't be done just by wage and benefit cuts to employees. So we need to make sure that you have the information that is needed in order to answer those questions. The third is to track costs over a long enough period of time to be realistic. Sometimes you have benefits in the first year, like when you have one-time cash infusion from the sale of assets like a bus fleet, and you have costs that show up down the road, like more purchases of buses. I've seen cost-benefit analyses done that are only on year one, and it obviously needs to be done over a significant enough period of time that you capture the real pros and cons of making this kind of decision. And finally, there has to be effective monitoring and enforcement mechanism of some kind. So let me give you examples of each of these. To start with, this is not from Central Point. This is from Lake Oswego in a contract that I looked at a number of years ago. And this is the issue of including state dollars as well as local dollars. In the contract, Lake Oswego decided to contract out its bus transportation to Laidlaw, which is now part of First Student. And part of its contract included something that I didn't understand at first. Lake Oswego said, we'll contract out, and whoever wins the bid needs to buy our bus fleet for $1 million. And Laidlaw, which is now First Student, looked at it and they said, well, we don't think it's worth $1 million. We think it's only worth $650,000. They said, well, I'll tell you what, we'll pay you the full million. And we'll say over 5 years, $350,000 with interest will become $400,000. We'll pay you the full million and you'll pay us back the difference. You'll pay us back the $400,000 over the 5 year contract at $80,000 a year. So basically, they said, we'll pay you $400,000 more than we think the fleet is worth and you'll pay it back to us over 5 years. I didn't understand what was the point, what was the logic of this transaction until I understood that what the district was doing was that First Student built the repayment charges into its per mile charges. That was sent to the state as transportation expense. The state reimburses 70% of all districts' transportation expense, which basically means there was a deal sweetener where First Student said, hey, we'll give you $400,000. You get to keep $280,000 of it because the state will pay that and the district only had to repay 30%. And when they did the cost-benefit analysis, they only counted the district dollars. They said, hey, we're going to make hundreds of thousands of dollars off of this, which was true, except that the same taxpayers of Oregon were just paying out of the other pocket out of the State Department of Education. So obviously, whatever the cost-benefit analysis is, seems like it needs to include all public dollars, whether they're state or local. Let me move on to talk about the Central Point contracting out with First Student, because this is really the prime test case. This is the first significant instance of contracting out since ORS 279B became law. And the first issue is what information is provided. What the statute says explicitly in black and white is that part of what what must be provided is, quote, actual salary or wage and benefit costs for employees by contractors, material costs, including space, energy, transportation, equipment, and supplies, and other miscellaneous costs. If you look at this, at least by the language of the statute, each one of these items was supposed to be provided, and none of them were provided by First Student. In fact, the district spent months asking for First Student for this information, but they refused to provide it. So what did they do instead is what they submitted to the state was an explicitly fictional cost-benefit analysis where they said, we know that First Student is going to cut people's wages and benefits, but let's imagine that it's going to pay exactly the same wages and benefits as people received as district employees, and then see if we can show that we're still making money off the deal. And if we are, we'll know that we're still making money without it being based on wage and benefit cuts. So they didn't provide any of the information, and they announced that they were going to save money. Now, in fact, not only did they not pay the same as under districts, but by our calculations, and again, this is based on going through extensive payroll records, accounting records, budget records, as well as one-on-one interviews with every First Student employee we could find, our calculation is that wages and benefits were cut by 47%, almost by half, through a combination of factors, including the fact that First Student, for instance, has a health insurance plan on paper, but in reality, the employees make so little and the copays and premiums are so high that nobody was using it, meaning the company wasn't spending anything on it. So you have a 47% wage and benefit cut, which is a huge amount of money. And then you say, well, how could they still be making money and have it not based on that? The answer is that the cost-benefit analysis that the district supplied the state simply omitted a whole lot of things, and either this is allowed by law or there's just not an enforcement mechanism, nobody really looking at things closely enough. What the district and First Student declared was that there would be annual savings of $106,000 a year, and then here's a list of some of the things that were missing. For one thing, every time, in every case that I've seen, when a school district contracts out busing, there's a huge increase in the number of buses purchased because the private companies require that a lot more buses be purchased and be gotten rid of at a younger age than they would be if they were district buses. In the cost-benefit analysis that Central Point presented to its school board, they assumed that the district would be buying the same number of buses whether or not they contracted out, but that's not true. And in fact, if you account for the difference in how many more buses would be bought by the decision to contract out, that's a very significant cost that was not included. There are small things like charging an annual rate increase higher than the rate of inflation. One of the big things is forfeiture of the bus fleet as an asset. In this contract, First Student bought Central Point school bus fleet and then built into its rate per mile charges such that the district would repay to First Student over a five-year contract 100% of the cost of the purchase cost of the fleet. So that transaction was basically a wash. The company gave the district money to buy the fleet and the district paid it back. But at the end of the 5 years, if they had kept service in-house, the district would still have the asset of the fleet, which by our calculations, the depreciated value after 5 years would be $875,000. By choosing to contract out, they gave up that asset. Now, in any rules of accounting, you have to include the forfeiture of assets as one of the costs, and this was simply omitted. So we had very sloppy things with just very big omissions that were not caught or were allowed. This case has been litigated. It's still on appeal. But at the first level, the court said that this analysis was fine. So in terms of how the language is being interpreted, at least at the first level of court, what was passed in the ORS 279B is being interpreted as you don't actually have to provide any of those listed items of information and cost-benefit analyses that would not stand up certainly in academia were allowed to go forward. Let me talk very briefly about the increase in bus purchases. This is Central Point. Central Point was purchasing two new buses per year in the 5 years prior to contracting out. And if you look at what would they have needed given the age of their bus and requirements to maintain a fleet according to state law, is they would have bought. I'm sorry, I don't have the numbers right in front of me. They would have bought a modest number of buses, I think 11 new buses during the course of the five-year contract. And by contrast, under First Student's contract, they're going to buy 43 buses, 19 new and the rest used. School district buses need to be inspected quarterly for roadworthiness and for student safety in a very rigorous manner. But as long as they're roadworthy and safe, they can operate for 15 years. They operate sometimes for 20 years. When private contractors contract to run school services, they insist on a much lower cutoff, and they insist on renewing buses and having newer buses. And so there's always a huge increase in bus purchases. One of the reasons that they do that is that the companies use the buses when they're not transporting students to run private charter bus services with buses that are entirely paid for by taxpayer dollars. Now, in both of these cases, in these two cases that I looked at, both in Central Point and in Lake Oswego where I looked at, their contract says explicitly in black and white that the buses can only be used for transporting students unless there is written permission from the district to be used for something else. And if they are used for something else, you can see in the bottom quote from the Lake Oswego thing, then everything must be accounted for, what they did, how much fuel they used. I spoke with the business managers in both places. Now you can see that First Student is running a commercial charter bus service in both places. This is the website from the address of the Central Point School Barn. And they advertise, quote, easy and efficient bus rental solutions for weddings, field trips, corporate transportation, other group outings. They take people to casinos, to football games, to the coast, to whatever you want. Neither district has given permission for this to happen. Both district financial managers told me that they did not give this permission for this to happen. I asked them, well, they're using your buses that you paid for, that taxpayers paid for. They're using your bus barns. How do you know if they hit a pothole while on one of these corporate outings and they bring it back to your bus barn that it's not publicly paid workers who are doing the repair with publicly paid parts? They said, we don't know. I said, how do you know if they're gassing up at your facility using publicly paid fuel, since the public buys the fuel in both contracts? In both cases, these are quotes from direct interviews with the finance directors of the school districts. They say they have no way of knowing and no records. So what we have is in violation of the contracts, but nevertheless very much in the open, private private commercial charter bus services being run with taxpayer buses, possibly with taxpayer fuel, with taxpayer maintenance, with taxpayer parts. One of the issues of monitoring things, oversight, and enforcement is when I brought up some of these issues to the State Department of Education, I discovered that there is exactly one person in the state of Oregon Department of Education who is responsible for overseeing everything to do with school transportation. They may have other responsibilities in addition to that, but there's not more than one person. This person doesn't have copies of the contracts, doesn't have any way to do enforcement, and so unless the legislature is going to fund a huge increase in enforcement, fuel enforcement staff, which I would guess is unlikely, then there has to be some mechanism for effective oversight and enforcement of this. Let me just wrap up by saying, you know, some of the longer-term concerns, first is that over time, when you say every bus must be gotten rid of when it reaches 12 years, even if you would keep using it if you were in the district, over time, the cost of that is greatly multiplied. When you have rate increases above inflation, as in the case of both the Lake Oswego and the Central Point contracts, in year one, the difference of half a percentage point in a rate increase is not very big. By year 20, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. There have been statistical studies that show that over time, particularly in rural districts when bus service is contracted out, the bus routes become less efficient in their geography because the district has an incentive to be as efficient as possible. But when you have a company that is being paid per mile, they have a different set of incentives. And finally, over time, once a district gives up its bus fleet, it's generally very hard to say realistically we may consider taking bus service back in-house because it's so expensive to buy a new fleet, which means when you come to negotiate your second contract, you're bargaining from a much weaker bargaining position. And the effects of that also show up only over time. This is some of the things that need to be taken into account why we need a longer time frame. The private use of buses is also one of the things, it may be a concern in itself, but also you could have a contract where the contract terms to the charges to the district are lesser if the company knows that we're going to be able to use public resources to operate a private charter bus service and they're 100% paid by taxpayers. Those costs need to be included if you want to do a cost-benefit analysis that includes everything. Let me just end by saying if you were if you were talking with somebody over coffee and they said, so basically how do these bus contracting out work? How does the economics of it work? And you were only allowed to say two sentences. The two biggest things that show up as cost items on either side of the ledger is that basically what happens in these deals is a very large cut in wages and benefits to employees, which is used to facilitate the purchase of a greatly increased number of buses that are then used for private commercial charter business. It's not up to me to decide what is good policy, but if that was not the intent of the legislature, you should know that that is what is now being allowed in the way the current law is being interpreted and implemented. Thank you again for the invitation to be here. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much, Gordon. Colleagues, yes, Senator Knoop.
Professor, have the unions paid for these types of studies in the past for you guys?
So again, I have not made a cent of money. I'm held to one standard, which is to do rigorous analysis. The way the University of Oregon works is that if you're not doing something that generates revenue like teaching classes, then something needs to be bought out. So the Oregon School Employees Association paid the University of Oregon, not to me or to anybody that I work with, to make it possible for us to do research as opposed to teaching classes or something else.
Sure. So release time, is that?
Yeah, that's how all kinds of, that's the same as if you got a grant from the Ford Foundation or from, you know, any place else that people look for grants.
Yeah, I'm not even suggesting it's wrong. I'm just saying that I just kind of wondered where the funding comes from for some of these studies.
So, you know, I would just say again, you know, I'm not starting to say anything about myself. I think one of the values of having tenured faculty is that the only standard we're held to is to follow the facts wherever they lead, and there is no career or financial implication whatsoever. If the facts showed this was a great deal for Oregon taxpayers, I would say this is a great deal for Oregon taxpayers. And if a union said, well, then we don't want to pay you anymore, that would be fine. My life would be completely the same. Maybe First Student would be happy to pay me. I don't know.
I have a question, Gordon. I'm intrigued by your point about how the districts might find themselves in a weaker bargaining position with the company after they've sold off their assets. Have you actually looked at some of the subsequent contracts and seen that? I mean, I think it makes sense hypothetically, but I wonder if the facts bear it out.
Well, it was, I will say, first of all, it was told to me by the financial director of the Lake Oswego School District, who said, of course, when we go to negotiate our second contract, we're going to be, you know, playing a weak hand because we can't, you know, there are only three major transportation companies, I think, that operate in Oregon, right? And to say we're not going to go with one of you is a very difficult option to have when you no longer have a bus fleet. In Lake Oswego, which has a much longer track record than Central Point, their average costs increased by 4.8% per year in the 8 years following contracting out. Now, I did not look closely enough to say exactly where that comes from, and I'm not privy to their negotiations, so I don't want to say anything I don't know for sure. But that's what the numbers look like, and that is what their business manager of their district told me.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Kelso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your work, did you do any look at the safety concerns and just the day-to-day management concerns of having such an important function contracted out to another entity?
I did. Again, I want to be very careful to state only the things that I really have proof of. I've seen studies from other states where there were safety concerns because with lower wage and higher turnover employees, you get people who are less trained, who know the routes less, who know the kids less, and there have been some safety concerns, but I have not done nor have I seen like statistical correlations. I've seen anecdotes about that, so I don't want to pretend to more certainty than I know about that.
Mr. Chair, the reason I ask, I served on a school board for 5 years, and I came onto the board shortly after that district had sold off its buses and contracted out. What was very frustrating was that we had many concerns brought to the attention of the school board about the safety practices of the bus company. Everything from kids being on buses for too long, air conditioners being broken, or wheelchairs being put on buses without being strapped down. And time and again, the district really had no capacity to be able to respond to those specific concerns because we had no personnel authority over those individuals and were locked into a contract. So, you know, financial considerations are always a concern. But I think when we look at the essential public services that our school districts provide, that our cities provide, that our counties provide, for me, the utmost concern is the safety of the public. And certainly as it relates to school-based custodians and school bus drivers, it's the direct health and safety of kids. And I'm just interested if there are any studies or any work looking into the facts around those issues, because I think we have an obligation to keep children safe.
I will look for one thing I can say that I have found is that you know, the things that make school districts look at contracting out tend to be that they're in a financial crunch. And the same financial crunch that leads to look to contracting out also leads them to cut management level and oversight level personnel. In one place that I looked at in Lincoln County, they used to have one manager for food service, one manager for custodial, and one manager for transportation. They collapsed those into one job, and then they started looking at contracting out. So by the time you get to contracting out, it's very common that there's virtually no capacity for oversight at the district level, which I think is why it may be so, you know, very important for you in crafting legislation to think about oversight and enforcement at this level, because there simply is not the staff to pay detailed attention to the kind of problems that you're raising, as far as I've seen.
Thank you, Gordon. Really
Thank
appreciate
you.
This one. Oh, okay. Vice Chair Thatcher.
Well, I was just looking at the very front of the Section 2. Just begins that an employee of a contracting agency that conducts a cost analysis and on may seek judicial review. So any employee, is that really the intention?
Yeah, actually, this is not his bill. But
oh,
Senator,
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
okay.
Senator Roblin is going to come up, and he can speak to the bill.
Thank you. Okay, because it seemed like it was very related, so I wasn't sure.
I'm sure you're right. Yeah. It's not mine.
Great. All right, thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Yeah. Now he knows that my question will be, so he can get to that.
The good senator from Coos Bay.
Yeah. So, Chair Dembro and committee, my name is Arnie Roblin. I'm senator from District 5. I'm here today to continue a process that began when I was in the House with House Bill 2867 that had to do with contracting out, and the statutes you see are based on that bill that was taken before. And after we had the bill passed. We had work groups that worked during the summer and other times with a number of people to finally get the statutes and the rules written kind of the way they have been. And since then, I have watched the process to see, are there other things that we could do to make it better? And it goes back to my being an administrator in a school district that had very difficult financial times, in which our school board decided that we should look at contracting out. And I was the administrator put on the team with the others to do the contracting out. In the process, we ended up contracting out two of the services that we've talked about here today. We did busing and we did food service. We chose not to contract out custodial in that process. And it has, in my mind, thinking back at that and thinking of what I gained and lost as a principal in a high school from doing that, a lot of the things that are embedded in the statute and in this new bill are things that came to light during that time for me. The biggest one had to do with the situation that was there. In our contracting out buses, our whole fleet went away and we started building new buses. And so I did realize very quickly that once the process was made, the decision was which of the three organizations that contract busing are we going to go with in the future. So you have a couple people you can negotiate with, so you do have some say to keep prices down, but it's not the same as when you own it yourself and you're doing with it. But having lost your infrastructure, it's really difficult to go back. We asked enough questions during the issue that we decided not to do custodials for a number of reasons. Reasons that I think are now more addressed in this bill, and that was for us, well, if I have a basketball game in the evening and I need a custodian, what's the charge going to be? And so all of a sudden we started adding up all the extra charges that we would get out of our employees who were already there, and we realized rapidly that it was probably not going to be a cost benefit for our school district to get rid of our employees, and so we decided not to do that. Over time, what you find is that when you had your food service program, what you fed kids was different because of the conversations that you have about what you're feeding than it is when a bigger corporation comes in, some good, some bad. And I guess my whole purpose here is to say, let's go through a process that gives elected school board members the information they need to make the best decision for the long term for their school district and not settle for the short term opportunity to save some money because we want to keep teachers in the classroom and we have a very difficult economic time. Hopefully, the legislature will come up with a sustainable way to fund education in a way that we can do the things that we need to do. This bill in particular does a group of things. It gives contracting agency a legal mechanism, a request for information, to get information needed to conduct cost analysis. Currently, agencies aren't allowed to communicate with potential contractors at this point in the procurement process. So you're going into procurement, you can't ask them certain questions because it's privileged information for them depending on who they're doing it. And this gives them permission to get some of that information necessary to make a good decision on a cost analysis. It adds reasonably foreseeable cost fluctuations and profit, prohibits inclusion of sale of long-term assets, which is the big issue with buses, and it adds the ability to correct the cost analysis if new information becomes available. Changes sole to primary in the sentence prohibiting contracting out of lower wages and benefits is the reason the contract is cheaper if in the analysis. Applies the same enforcement mechanism, judicial writ of review, to cost analysis. And this is probably the hardest one for me. We don't have a lot of processes that give us the opportunity to do it. We look through different things. Writ of judicial review was the quickest, easiest way to have someone on the outside look at the process to see if, in fact, it actually makes sense. It is an appropriate process. The state agencies, unless specifically exempt from the public contracting laws, most cities, counties, school districts, and in outsourcing contracts above $250,000 are who is affected. There are a few smaller school districts that are exempt from it. There's a few others. You can see that in the bill. That's always been there. Senate 414 will not stop contracting out of public sector services and jobs. It will assure that it's done right and for the right reasons, and hopefully expedited. We've still got, as you heard, the Central Point lawsuit is going on. Right now, you can't challenge any of those other parts until after the contract is let, and then you go to the regular court system, which could take many, many years and cost a lot of money for school districts and for the companies themselves and for the associations. Next, in the judicial writ, the review process brings enforcement of cost analysis requirements in line with other parts of the public contracting law by establishing a judicial writ of review as the appropriate process for a challenge. The judicial writ review will settle disputes quickly and assure accurate information is considered during the deliberation process prior to contracting out. Errors can be corrected on either side based on accurate information projections or contract costs. In the request for information, it provides a request for information process in the cost analysis statute so information needed to complete the cost analysis can be legally obtained, and no legal way to currently exist for obtaining that information, so that's why that's necessary. Other elements, it prohibits consideration of the sale of long-term assets in the cost analysis. You heard a little bit about that from our doctor a little while ago. And it requires the inclusion of estimated contractor profit in the analysis. State agencies currently do this. Local governments and school districts do not. Clarifies that lower wages and benefits of the workforce may not be the primary reason for the cost savings. If a contract is to be awarded, current law uses words sole in that particular place, and requires inclusion of reasonably foreseeable fluctuations in costs as a standard in the contract estimating. And I think that takes into consideration the more long-term issues as we look outward to see what's going to happen with respect to contracting out. I really give this bill to you for your consideration. I think there are things and opportunities for people to have conversations about it, and if there's things that in particular you think need to be changed, I know that there's people here that are willing to have those conversations. And any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Senator Roblin, thank you for bringing this bill forward. And yes, I mean, I think that if there is further work to be done with it, I appreciate your offering that up. So the conversation so far has been all about school districts and, you know, with the example of buses, for example. You know, I see on my sign-up sheet there are people here who are not from school districts, who are from local governments. Do you have a sense of how this would
– yeah,
we'll hear
for,
from
that. Well, it will take time, and they have to put an effort into it. My belief continues to be that – when they do this and they really think about it over the long term, they will make better decisions for their organizations, as school districts will make better decisions for their organizations. They obviously are different. I have not worked in them. I've worked in a water board, and we did a lot of contract negotiations. We didn't do a lot of subcontracting out. We had our own team. But when it came to large projects, we oftentimes did that. And I think we always look to figure out in any of those situations, if you're a board member, how do we do this in a way that over the next 15 or 20 years is going to produce the best opportunities for us? And I think what we're trying to do here is say, let's do a process that's really good when we're making big decisions with respect to how we spend public money in the long term. And at the end of the day, can we justify that what we've done based on it's going to save money in the long term and continue to have the assets we need as a city or a community or whatever? And they know better than I, and they'll be here to talk to you. So,
okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Yes.
Well, I have my one question that I asked the previous person mistakenly, but I was wondering about the very first line of, I think it was Section 2. Essentially, it just talks about how any employee, it sounds like any employee within the department can make
I when we were writing this, it's kind of like, let's figure out how do we get this process going. And I think we're willing to have a conversation about that. Those are the issues that I think need to be brought up. We need to think about them clearly, and we need to come up with a decision at the end of the day that you feel comfortable with as a board.
Yeah, I guess one of my concerns would be, it just seems like it could just be used as a tool to stop any contracting out from ever being thought of, because you're just going to make it miserable for people. I mean, really, that's
no. I understand that.
What would happen?
And that is not the intent, to make this a tool to stop that. I really do believe that it is the intent to make sure that we spend public money the right way.
Great. Thanks for that question. I think that is important, that the bill more clearly identify who would intervene.
Right.
And what might trigger it.
And what might trigger it for all kinds of things, yeah.
For any reason.
Yep.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Senator, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, and have a wonderful time deliberating on all these wonderful ideas.
Great, thank you. So I'm suspending.
I'm not sure how we phrase it. That's a good question.
All right. Well, I'm going to suspend the hearing on Senate Bill 414, and I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 128. And Matt, would you please tell us what this bill is?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 128 defines comparable for the purpose of establishing base pay for the Department of State Police telecommunicators as the base pay for telecommunicators employed by the five Oregon public safety answering points with the most employees. It has no revenue impact and may have a fiscal impact, but a statement has not yet been issued.
Okay, so we have, I believe, a panel of four. Mike Highway, Heather Whitaker, Tina Freeman, and John something. You'll tell us, I'm sure. Okay. Who wants to lead off? Tell us what we're dealing with here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michael Ewy. Last name is Iwai. I'm the vice president with the Oregon State Police Officer Association, and we're here before you asking for support in Senate Bill 128. The goal of Senate Bill 128 is to recruit and retain high-quality dispatchers, or in the bill it's referred to as telecommunicators. Right now, through a recent study, we've been able to determine, comparing Portland, Salem, Washington County, Clackamas County, and also Lane County, that our telecommunicators are underpaid by approximately 25% among the major comparators. This is very problematic when we're looking at trying to recruit, retain, and the overall wellness of our dispatchers. So we would ask that you support Senate Bill 128. As you know, it basically just talks about the arbitration process, and with the arbitration process, it will include the five top comparables with respect to five answering points in the state. So we have some dispatchers here that actually do the job that would like to give their testimony with respect to how they see Senate Bill 128. And again, I just thank you for your time and ask that you support Senate Bill 128.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and the committee. My name is Heather Whitaker. I am a telecommunicator two for 9 years, and here with the Oregon State Police Officers Association asking for your support in Senate Bill 128. I have witnessed over the years a retention issue with the telecommunicators at the Oregon State Police due to a higher pay wage in some of the other agencies. We will spend time training, putting through background investigation, sending to DPSST, which is a two-week program, a lot of output of time and monies, all obviously paid for by the taxpayer, and to find that they will stay for a short period of time until they're certified, and then they move on to the higher paying agencies. For those of us who have stayed, it does add a huge stress to us, constantly being understaffed, and a burnout of our trainer, so to speak. And I think at this point I'm going to refer to my cohorts.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. And if one of you, either you or one of the others, can give us an idea of who's your competition here, you know, in terms of who you are losing people to. I don't know, whoever wants
so
to.
So it would be the five largest cities, typically, the city of Portland.
Actually, before you answer, could you introduce yourself for the record, John? Especially because I couldn't read your last name.
John Stevie, telecommunicator to Oregon State Police Officers Association. It's going to be the five largest agencies in the state. Typically, that's going to be Marion County or Willamette Valley 911, City of Portland, Lane County, and Washington County. We've lost employees to all of those centers once they develop their skill set at OSP. They go on to those centers and become successful and work in there. So those are the basic five that we would be compared to.
And Ms. Freeman?
No. Yes. I'm Tina Freeman. I'm telecommunicator for 9 years with OSPOA. And we actually, there's two separate call centers that we represent. And I'm from the southern one. We even have a county down there that is struggling financially. They laid off all of their dispatchers, and so we hired a few of them on. And then as soon as their center opened again, they left, but because of more money in a county that is struggling financially. So that kind of paints a picture.
Great. Colleagues, any questions? Yes, Vice Chair.
Maybe, yeah, thank you. Maybe someone can explain to me, aren't you part of a bargaining unit, and does this ever come up? I mean, why? It seems like a wage would be a basic thing to talk about during these negotiations, and why hasn't that happened? Or I'm sure you've talked about it, but what's going on here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, we're here representing the bargaining association, which is part of our job, is to bargain. The issue that surrounds Senate Bill 128 that we want the department to consider is to consider the five top comparables, which is currently what we do with the troopers. So we were just trying to piggyback on what we've done for our troopers to address the retainability, the recruitment, and the wellness. We like to extend that to our dispatchers because, as you know, our dispatchers, they also work in an environment that has hypervigilance, meaning they're always expected to be on. They're experiencing the same thing that the trooper's experiencing via through the radio or on the phone. They're just not there as we're doing the job. So in order for us to do that, we have to make their wages more comparable, just like we've done with the troopers with respect to the pay parity issue. And that's essentially what we're trying to address. Is we have a small group of folks, approximately 60 dispatchers, that this will affect, so the fiscal should be minimal.
I guess I understand that that's what you're trying to do, but it seems like what I would think that the venue would be, you know, during negotiations and not going to the legislature. And I'm wondering if that's short-circuiting it, or why aren't they looking at comparables, I guess.
When we have the bargaining process, they don't have to take in right now the top five comparators. And what this bill addresses is it says you will have to take the top five comparators when you're trying to negotiate pay for the telecommunicators. So we can attempt to bargain wages and benefits for our telecommunicators, but there's nothing that says right now that the department, or DAS for that matter, has to incorporate their comparators, their comparables. And that's what we're trying to get on.
Senator Thatcher, I'm sorry. I think it sets a minimum of what to look at, because no one does what we do on a level we do that would be Idaho State Police or Washington State Police. So we need to have a base level of the five top agencies that we lose people to. Why do our people go to there, and why do they become successful? So that needs to be our starting off point.
Right. You are not in a typical bargaining situation, right? Being you're part of the fire and police, right? That means you can't strike.
That's correct. Looking at
comparables, that's an essential part of how your agreements are settled, right?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And so, is it an arbitrator that will look at this, or someone who will look at this and make that determination?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if the bargaining team representing both sides, the association and the department, cannot come to a resolution, then yes, it will go to arbitration. And what this bill does is just forces them to look at the top five answering points in the state. So it basically sets the ground rules that here are the comparators based upon what the dispatchers have previously said.
Thank you. And I just want to say thank you for what you do. I could not do that job. I wouldn't. It would be grueling. Thank you for doing
that. Thank you. And Mike, do you have a sense of where the agency is on this? Are they opposed to this? Nobody has signed up to speak.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I cannot speak on behalf of the department. What I can say is typically the state agencies, they will remain neutral, and I know that they're not in opposition of it. But as far as what they're going to say publicly will probably be that they're going to remain neutral.
Thank you. All right. Thank you all. Thank you all for coming forward. Do you have anything else you want to say, Mike?
Mr. Chair, no, thank you.
Or anyone else?
No, thank you.
This is your chance.
The only thing that I wanted to add, and I don't have any of those figures, but just from being
in the position for 9 years, it seems to me that as we're bringing people in and spending these monies in order to train them, then to lose qualified applicants to another facility, we are really spinning our wheels and wasting taxpayers' money.
It's a significant investment getting them in the door, passing the background check, getting them up to speed. You're looking at 6 to 9 months to train somebody to get them qualified to be on their own. Another 5, 10 months, they go to another center, and that's a huge investment that we lose and have to reinvest in a new employee again.
And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the one final thing I would ask that you consider is that the dispatchers, they're a 24-hour service all the time. They're supposed to be there answering the phones, assigning calls to troopers, or working with our partner agencies to make sure that whoever needs our assistance is going to get that assistance. So it's very important. We'd like to keep our dispatchers relevant within the market environment, and we can only do that by making their wages and benefits more comparable with other organizations. So I ask for your support, please.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming all this way. So where are you from, Ms. Freeman?
I'm from Central Point.
Okay, great, yeah. It's down the road. All right, thank you all very much for coming.
Thank you.
Colleagues will look into scheduling a work session for this sometime soon. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 128. I'm going to bring Peggy up.
Okay, it's 185.
And do we have anyone signed up?
Just Peggy.
Okay, and I am going to open a public hearing, bear with me, folks, on Senate Bill 185, because I see our presenter here. And so I'm going to call up Ms. Boquist. And Matt, can you tell us what this bill does?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 185 creates an unlawful business practice if employers require employees or applicants to establish or maintain social media accounts. The measure also prohibits employers from requiring employees or applicants to authorize the employer to advertise on their personal social media accounts. There is no revenue impact. There may be a fiscal impact, but a statement has not yet been issued.
Okay, thank you very much, Matt. Peggy, welcome. Can you tell us what has prompted this bill?
Chairman Dembrough, members of the committee, I'm Peggy Boquist from Dallas, Oregon. A little background on this. A Navy veteran who I know, who's in Senator Roblin's district, incidentally, he returned home from the Navy. I was talking to him, and he mentioned that he was looking for work. I said, hey, there's a new sporting goods store, a nationally known sporting goods store that's being built in Wilsonville, and I bet they would like a guy like you there. He applied for that job. He applied online. It's an online. He got a callback. The callback said you left the Facebook identifier blank on your application, and he said, I don't have a Facebook. Never have had a Facebook. He was in the Navy, and he had some friends that experienced some consequences for having a Facebook. So they said, well, get a Facebook and we'll interview. And he said, I'm not going to get a Facebook. I'm not going to have a Facebook. And so he did not get hired. He did not get the interview. He may have not actually gotten hired anyway, but he was on the road to being hired. He had a 4-year college degree, 6 years in the Navy. He was a good guy. So when we were submitting some bills for our constituents, I mentioned this to somebody I know that could help me sponsor this, and I said, I really want this. I know there may be other laws out there, but I don't think an employer should require an employee to have a Facebook. And it, of course, the bill that was written from my generating the worksheet for this is actually, I think, very good, and they've had some safeguards in here, not just for the applicant or the worker, but also for the employer. And so I would like your support on this bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Peggy. So why do you think the company had this requirement? What do you think they were, I mean, what were they after? Do you know?
Well, Chairman Dembrough, in my personal experience on Facebook, I have a granddaughter, so I'm on Facebook. I have an 18-month-old granddaughter, most beautiful baby in Polk County, for the record. She did win the year. I watch my granddaughter, and I do see things from friends who do work for different companies. I have a good friend who works a good friend in the Army back in the day. She is retired from the military like I am, and she works for Clinique at Macy's. I get a couple of Clinique ads every week. Not attached to her Facebook page, but it comes to me. I don't purchase Clinique. I've never been on their mailing list. So my assumption is that maybe she, too, is required to do some advertising, but I've not asked her that. I believe that maybe this nationally known sports company in Wilsonville may have a similar requirement. And I do not know what other states, how they manage this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So that's what I believe, is that they probably do some advertising on the site.
Okay. So presumably, if he started working for them, his place of employment would be listed, and that would then become a way of getting information about that company out there?
Chairman Dimbro, that's what I believe. They would boost their marketing through their employees' Facebooks, which, incidentally, is probably a great marketing idea. But I like some privacy in our lives, and I think that crosses the line.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Peggy, thank you for bringing this to us. I assume it would be the Bureau of Labor that would enforce this if it became law?
Chairman Dembro, Senator Rosenbaum, I would hope that it would be Boley that would.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Senator Knope, then Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Peggy, I mean, you may know that we passed two laws last year as it relates to Facebook and passwords not being able to be requested by employers or by education entities. And it seems like your bill fits very well in that complement of bills that says, you know, for me as an employer, and I'm also an employee, that you can't force someone to take up something that could potentially put them in jeopardy, because there's been all kinds of issues related to social media stalking and things like that. And there might be a reason why an employee doesn't want to be on social media. And I can think of dozens of reasons why that could be. So I think your bill is worthwhile. And I guess that's more of a comment than a question, but I applaud you for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it's clear in the text, but just to clarify, this prohibits the employer from requiring, but it does not prohibit the employee from choosing to put whatever out that they might want to.
Chairman Dembro, Senator Gelser, yes, that's what I read also. And I would hope that an employer would never use a subtle, compelling motivation or something in that way, but that's what I read also.
Okay, Peggy, sounds like you've gotten a sympathetic reception here.
Thank you.
We will look into scheduling this one as well. Thank you. Okay, so with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 185 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 288. Matt?
Senator Dembro, Chair Dembro, members of the committee, Senate Bill 288 grants reinstatement rights to recently terminated, unclassified, or exempt service employees who have immediate prior former regular status in classified service. There is no revenue impact. It may have a fiscal impact, but a statement has not yet been issued.
Okay, and I have Madeline Zeike? No. Yes. From DAS. Welcome, Madeline. Thank you.
Thank you.
So what is this all about?
Well, good afternoon, Chair Dembro and members of the committee. This is my first appearance before you in my relatively new role at DAS as their Chief Human Resources Officer. So very excited to be here. I'm here to talk about Senate Bill 288, which is the companion bill to one you had last session, which was Senate Bill 1567 regarding restoration rights for management service employees in state government. 2 years ago, we signed a letter of agreement with SEIU to limit the period of time a management unclassified or exempt service employee had to return to their prior union-represented position to 3 years. The restoration rights for management and services employees were handled last session in that bill, but clear language about the unclassified and exempt employees was inadvertently not included. So the intent of this bill is to limit the restoration rights of unclassified and exempt service employees who attained regular status in a represented classified position. Some agencies have established a practice of restoring these employees back, and with this bill it will be clear that there will be no restoration rights after a 3-year period in their new positions, which is consistent with the bill last session. However, since this particular bill was written, we've had several conversations about the clarity of the bill. In those conversations, it's become apparent that the bill needs some additional work in order for its intent to be clear. We would appreciate the opportunity to have some additional time to clarify the bill and welcome the chance to discuss it with the committee at a further date. We've also been collaborating with our labor partners, so they're well aware of what we're doing in crafting this bill. So today we'd like to request permission of the chair to work with Legislative Council and DOJ on an amendment that will provide clarity regarding this bill and its intent, and we will continue to work with labor as we craft that. Thank you for the opportunity to provide you with the testimony today, and that was all I had for you with your busy schedule.
Thank you very much, Madeline. And I think I've already given the permission to have the work done. And colleagues, before I take questions, let me just say that this issue is a continuation of an effort that has been underway actually for a couple of biennia related to our efforts to work on the management to staff ratios within our state agencies, trying to make them more compact and more efficient. And, you know, as that has created certain, you know, issues about what happens to a manager, what kind of rights do they have to go back into a bargaining unit position. And so there needed to be some clarification around that, which we started to do in 2013. I guess didn't get all the way, so this will take care of that last area to be fixed. So, Vice Chair Thatcher.
And that was my question. It was 1567 from 2013, correct, that we're just adding in these inadvertently left off classifications or whatever you want to say, groups of employees.
Yeah, I think that's the intent, and we need to make sure that the bill really does that.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions? Okay, then thank you very much, Madeline, and we will eagerly await the amendments that can allow us to move forward.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. With that, I will close the public hearing. Let's, colleagues, since we're all here and everybody seems to be in a good mood, this is, I think, a good time for us to go into a work
session. I can change that.
Go into a work session on. We have a couple of bills that we heard last week, 2 weeks ago, related to unemployment insurance that we needed paperwork on. We've been waiting for it. We now have it. And so I will open a work session on the first of those, which is Senate Bill 242. And Matt, could you remind us what this one is?
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, Senate Bill 242 expands reasons for which the Employment Department may request from the federal government an offset against liquidated state debt to include debtors' failure to report earning accurately or failure to repay debt for which they are liable. The measure deletes provisions disqualifying individuals in work-share programs from receiving benefits for any week in which hours worked exceed hours set forth in the approved plan. The measure also requires employers in work-share programs to be charged for shared work benefits in the same manner employers are charged for regular or extended benefits. Declares an emergency effective on passage. There are both revenue and fiscal statements associated with this bill, and it will require a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 242 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Thatcher moves Senate Bill 242 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion of this? Is there any objection to this moving to the floor with a due pass recommendation? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, it was to Ways and Means.
With the subsequent referral, yeah.
Just to clarify.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
Oh, okay. Next one, huh?
Oh, yeah, right. Sorry.
All right.
Okay, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 242, open a work session on Senate Bill 243. And actually, Matt, why don't you remind us of this one?
Thank you, Chair Dembro and members of the committee. Senate Bill 243 clarifies that an individual who has overpaid unemployment insurance benefits through no fault of their own is liable to have the balance deducted from future benefits paid by another state. The measure increases from 3 to 5 years, the period before which employment department director may consider unrecoverable any benefits overpaid to an individual because of false statement, misrepresentation, or nondisclosure of fact, declares emergency effective on passage, and there are revenue and fiscal statements for this measure and will require a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Ready for me?
Please.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 243 move to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Thatcher moves Senate Bill 243 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion of this? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Senate Bill 243 will move to the floor and referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. So with that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 243. And do we have a committee bill?
Oh, we do have an LC, yes.
Yeah. And I'm actually going to open a work session for the purpose of introducing a committee bill.
All righty. We're jumping all over the agenda today, aren't we? Okay.
Okay, actually, before you do that, Matt, tell us what this is.
Yes. Chair Dembro, members of the committee, LC 3727 considers an individual enrolled in alternative education programs to be considered out-of-school youth for the purpose of Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act.
Okay, Vice Chair Thatcher.
Mr. Chair, I move that LC 3727, dated February 17th, 2015, be introduced as a committee bill.
Vice Chair Thatcher moves that LC 3727, dated February 17th, 2015, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? And colleagues, I'll just tell you, this is an effort for us to get the state aligned with the new Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, dealing with those students who have dropped out of their original high school and are now in alternative school to allow them to be a focus of efforts in getting them into employment. So. But again, even though this is a great bill, your voting to move this forward is no indication on your feelings about the bill at this point. So are there any questions about it? Any objections to this being introduced as a committee bill? Seeing none, so ordered. Okay, I'll close our work session, and I'm going to reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 414. We do have a sign-up sheet. I'm going to call up a panel of four, so if you can all fit up there. Sarah Drescher, Joe Basler, Stacy Cowan, and Graham Traynor, please. Okay. Choose your initial spokesperson.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, my name is Joe Basler. I get to go first. I represent Oregon AFSCME. We're the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees for Oregon. We represent about 24,000 members around the state. We represent folks in state government, local government, and also private nonprofits. And I can say that the folks who work in private nonprofits, we have a lot of difficulty. They don't generally make as much or have as good benefits as those in the public sector. And so all of our members are very concerned about contracting out, which this bill addresses. You know, there's two real concerns for us around contracting out. The first is pretty obvious. We get worried that our folks are going to make less money and have less benefits. But the second problem is sort of a loss of public trust. A lot of times when a contract happens, our members are the canaries in the coal mine. We're the first ones who say, uh-oh, we don't think this is a good idea. This is bad. And they want to raise a hand up and say, don't do this, don't do this. And then it happens anyway because it seems like it's saving some money. And then when it doesn't end up saving any money or it goes bad, they feel like the public sector gets blamed for the failure of a private company from doing the public contract, and they get lumped in with the bad job the public sector did. So they warn, and then they're the ones who also feel like they take the brunt of the abuse when it goes bad. This bill, one of my first jobs were asked me was working on this public contracting bill that Senator Roblin mentioned earlier. You know, I think the most important part is that it lets you sort of raise these flags and have these concerns before the contract happens, which is essential because after it happens, there's very little you can do about it. I have a one very, very rare example of how something like this has happened in a good way. In Clackamas County, they had no law forcing them to do this, but Clackamas County was about to contract out their grit hauling. I won't explain what grit hauling is exactly. I just say it's after you finish water cleaning, it's the leftover. It's gross. But they were going to contract out all the grit hauling. Our members sort of caught wind of it, and several of the commissioners sort of asked what we thought, and we were able to prove really quickly and really well that you would save far more money keeping it in-house. And the commissioners agreed, and we kept it in-house. But that was the only example of that we have of showing when the public employees pointed out it was a bad idea that the county commission stopped and did the right thing. More often what happens is we say, we're worried, we have a problem, they contract out, you know, custodial work or medical treatment in a jail. And before the year, before the first contract's done, already the cost, they'll get a warning. Cost is going to be higher than we thought. It's going to be more expensive than we thought. But by that time, the contract's signed, it's locked in, and the service is gone. And the people who were working that job have found another job or moved on. So the important part about this bill, I think, like I said, is that it allows that cost-benefit analysis to be examined before the contract's signed, so that if it is a mistake, there's enough time to slow down, think about it, and make sure we're doing the right job and making sure public money is protected. That's all I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. My name is Stacey Cowan. I'm with SEIU Local 503. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 414. We represent, similar to Joe, we represent about 55,000 workers statewide. That includes state workers, local government workers, private nonprofit. It does include some care provider workers as well. But as far as the contracting goes, many of our members are again, I would just echo the sentiments that Joe said. I'm very interested in the contracting process. For a number of reasons, and a lot of what Joe said. Again, just to kind of reiterate, we've talked a lot about the feasibility process. So the legislation that was passed in 2009 looks at comparing the anticipated cost to contract out the work versus what it would cost to keep the work in-house. And specifically to procurement on services for more than $250,000. So we're really just talking about a small section of work being contracted out. The purpose of the legislation really was just to ensure that we're being the most efficient with taxpayer dollars. There are times that it makes sense to contract out work, and there are times that you get a good value for that. There are times that it doesn't make sense. There are times that it makes more sense to keep the work in-house. The feasibility study provides a process for us to make that analysis so that, again, on the front end, we know that we're making the best decision possible. The feasibility studies are really about avoiding unnecessary and wasteful contracts. I think we're all very familiar with headlines that we've seen about wasteful contracts gone bad, quality of work being poor. The point of the feasibility study is to try to gather as much information on the front end as possible so that we can make the best decision possible. One piece that was missing, and this has become apparent since 2009, is the enforcement mechanism. There was really no check or balance placed on the feasibility study mechanism that was developed in 2009. Senate Bill 414 allows for an existing judicial review process to be used when the public contracting agencies fail to provide, comply with the provisions in ORS 279B. This bill helps provide some of that check and balance that we're talking about, again, when we're talking about procurement for services. We're going to hear about some examples. I think Gordon outlined some examples of why this is necessary. We've seen several examples in cases where employers just have flat out refused to do a feasibility study, even when the law required them to do so. One example that we have is at the city of Wilsonville. They contracted out operation of a wastewater treatment plant. Apparently that's a popular thing to contract out. And they just did it without performing a feasibility study. There was no recourse. There was no way to contest it, even though we knew it was going to cost considerably more to contract out the work than to do that in-house. We feel, just to kind of put a period on the end of the thought, that the law, a law that can't be enforced at best has limited value. We think that this will provide an efficient process to be able to add an enforcement mechanism, again, to make sure that we're being as efficient as possible with state dollars, tax dollars. So thank you for that.
Thank you very much, Stacey.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, my name is Graham Traynor, representing the Oregon AFL-CIO, the statewide federation of labor unions, representing over 300,000 workers in Oregon. And we've had a long history of weighing in on issues around public contracting and ensuring that taxpayer dollars are getting the best deal. Taxpayers are getting the best deal as public employers make these decisions about how to best provide these vital services in our communities, but at the same time making sure that workers' rights are protected in the process. You've heard about the legislature's progress on this front from the 2009 bill, House Bill 2867, and as you've also heard, now that that's been on the books, I think that there's some basic cleanup work that needs to be done to make sure that the intent of the bill and of that law is really realized in the state, throughout the state. You know, the public procurement process is, as we're all aware, is very complex, but we believe that Senate Bill 414 really addresses some basic issues that have come to light in recent years, and that we've realized since the implementation of House Bill 2867. And one area that you've heard a little bit about that I wanted to just highlight in the bill is the judicial writ of review process. You know, we feel like that by bringing the enforcement of cost analysis requirements in line with other parts of public contracting law, we believe this will make the process more efficient and allow, as you've heard elsewhere, that disputes being settled more efficiently. To make sure that accurate information is considered before a decision to contract out jobs is made rather than after the fact. And I believe most of everything I had prepared has been covered today, so I'll just save the committee's time. But we do encourage the committee's support for Senate Bill 414, and we appreciate the opportunity to share our perspective on the bill today. Thanks.
Thanks, Graham.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Drescher. I'm an attorney with Tedesco Law Group. We represent public and private sector labor unions throughout the state of Oregon. We represent firefighters, police officers, city, state employees, and we represent the Oregon School Employees Association, which are the classified employees in most of the school districts in all of Oregon. These are your custodians, your bus drivers, your secretaries, your cooks, the people who are doing the work every day with the students. And what I have seen is that those classified employees are bearing the brunt of a loophole in Oregon's contracting code. And let me tell you what that loophole is. Under the contracting code, these public agencies and local governments must complete a cost analysis before they can contract out the jobs. And as we know, these requirements were added not only to ensure cost savings, but to ensure that those savings were not at the expense of family wage jobs. In other words, if the savings are simply from slashing wages and benefits, a public agency, a local government, cannot contract out the jobs. But here's the loophole. Under the current law, there is no enforcement mechanism. There's no legal process to challenge a contracting agency's or local government's violation of that cost analysis. And because there is no legal process to challenge this, These unlawful decisions to contract out, as we saw from Mr. Lafer's presentation, are issued at whim. And Mr. Lafer asked a good question and not so many words when he showed you the evidence. He asked, how did they get away with this? And my answer to you is, because there is no enforcement mechanism. As I was searching for a million quarters to pay the parking meter outside today, I wondered if I was going to get a parking ticket. And I thought, if no one enforced this, I probably won't. And I think the same is true for this law. Without an enforcement mechanism, why comply? And that is exactly what we have seen with these school districts contracting out our public family wage jobs to private entities. And I've experienced this firsthand. I'm the attorney who is handling the litigation currently pending before the Oregon Court of Appeals involving the Central Point School District. And I will tell you there, a former school bus driver who lost her job to outsourcing had no mechanism for challenging the decision. So what we did is we filed a lawsuit under Oregon's Declaratory Judgment Act. And let me tell you what the defendants argued. The school district and First Student argued, you don't get to challenge this under the Oregon Declaratory Judgments Act. You have to file a writ of review. Well, guess what? There's no writ of review process in the contracting code. And guess what this legislation before you does? It adds the writ of review process. You want the writ of review process? Here it is. Give us a way to challenge unlawful decisions. That is at the heart of this legislation before you, and it will allow us to ensure that that 2009 legislation serves its goals of preserving family wage jobs in Oregon and ensuring that taxpayer money is well spent. In addition, among the other things, this law provides procedures for public agencies to obtain that information that's necessary to do the cost analysis. In Mr. Lafer's presentation, he showed you a spreadsheet where the school district hadn't provided any of that information. This law before you says, here's how you get that information. Here's how you do it, and ensures that it gets there. It also ensures that public agencies will update their cost analyses if they receive new information. And it includes fluctuations in the costs of a contractor and requires them to include their profit. As I told the Oregon Court of Appeals about a year ago, if we're spending taxpayer dollars to a private entity to do our work, don't we have the right to know how that money is being spent? Don't we have the right to know if they're using our public buses to do gambling trips? That's the intent of this law. It's transparency and the preservation of family wage jobs. Now, before I finish, let me just say that I know what Vice Chair Thatcher had pointed out was her concern, that this law would allow any employee of an agency to challenge this. And let me just be clear that in order for an employee or his or her union to challenge this, there are several things that must be made. First of all, the agency or local government has to make the decision that it wants to contract out. Second of all, there has to be an allegation that the contracting agency has violated the cost analysis provisions. Third, the contracting agency has to get notice from the employee or the union and have 30 days to correct their deficiency. And fourth, the employee or the union has to exhaust any administrative procedure. This is checks and balances. This ensures that it's not at whim. Any employee will just go filing this lawsuit against these school districts or public agencies. There is a process that ensures lower dispute resolution is achieved. And lastly, as I know my opposition will get up here and say, this will make it harder for us to contract out. And my response is, good. You're contracting out public services to a private entity. Imagine someone contracting out your job. Do you want it to be done in a day? Or do you want them to take the time to gather the information and to do it right? We owe this to the taxpayers of Oregon. We owe it to our public employees. I urge you to pass this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Colleagues. Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
I know a lot of the discussion has revolved around local governments, school districts, et cetera, but how about state government like DAS, for instance? Are they included in this?
Correct,
as well?
Yes, they are. Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Thatcher. Yes, DAS would be included in this. Any state agency would be included in this.
Mm-hmm. I have a question anyone can answer. You know, with respect to the need to get as much information up front as possible, which I think makes a lot of sense, how exactly does this bill change the practice that was set into effect by the 2009 bill?
If I may. Chair Dembro, members of the committee, the problem with the current bill is that it says before conducting a procurement for services, which is before outsourcing, you have to do this cost analysis. And what the local agencies, state agencies, local governments have struggled with is, all right, well, we have to do a cost analysis before we can conduct a procurement. The problem is where they usually get their information to do the cost analysis is through the procurement process, by soliciting bids, by getting information from potential contractors. And so what we have heard from the other side is that, look, we don't have the ability to fill out these cost analyses correctly because we don't have the information from the contractors until we go through with the procurement process. And under the existing law, we have to do the cost analysis before we get to the procurement process. So what this law did is specifically to address that concern, adds a provision that you first get information. You get all the information you can, and that is not proceeding with the contracting out process. You get to do that, no one gets to question it, no procurement process has begun yet. So it provides that opportunity for local governments and contracting agencies to get all the information they need on the front end before they do the cost analysis.
Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
Well, I guess why would a company, a private business, give that information if they're not even in the process of procurement? It just seems like there's not even a relationship set up yet.
Well, presumably there's a potential procurement would be announced. Is that right?
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Thatcher, that's exactly right. Keep in mind, they want to do business with the state. And it should be the policy of the state that if you want to do business with the state, you want to take our taxpayers' money, shouldn't you provide us with the information as to what you're going to do with that taxpayer money? That's just sound policy.
Okay, so I'm sorry.
Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
Am I to understand that you're trying to figure out, okay, the profit? Okay. How would that be determined ahead of time necessarily? I guess you can, it would just be an estimate and...
One of the provisions of the proposed bill is that they provide information about potential profit. Is that what you're referring to?
Right. I'm not sure how accurate something like that could be.
And Chair Dembro and Vice Chair Thatcher, those are the exact questions we want answered. And there should be a conversation, a back and forth. What are your requirements, Central Point School District? How many buses do you require? How many routes do you have? Let us give you the information about what it would cost us, including our profit margin, because guess what? That profit is being paid by taxpayer dollars. That's a conversation that should happen. If you were asking someone to do a service for you on your car, on your house, wouldn't you like to know what are the materials? How much are you going to spend on that? What am I paying for this? This is taxpayer money. It should be set forth in these categories. We should know where it's going.
Actually, don't ask how much are you making on this. I personally just want to get the outcome of what I asked for, and for a good price, and get the service I want. But aside from that, I'm just wondering how this process would work. I had a question there, but then mm-hmm. you mentioned that, and it kind of got me sidetracked. Yeah. So I'm sorry.
Well, thank you. Well, hold on to it because we will also be hearing from other people, and
okay.
That may help clarify. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much, all four of you.
Thank you.
Yep. All right, let's see. Should we do these three? Is it just him?
There's three. He's the last one. Four, that's crossed.
Yeah. Okay, let's have an education panel. Devin Hunter, Lori Satinspiel, and Jake Gibbs. You're all pro-education, right?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Sure. Well, I'm
Devin Hunter. I'm from Hillsborough Classified United, affiliated with AFT Oregon. I work for the Hillsborough School District as a technology support specialist. I was there kind of near the tail end of the school district's decision in 2006 to actually contract out custodial services. So they went through the whole process. As far as anyone knew at the time, especially the union, when we complained about them contracting out, what we understood is that it was basically just the way they were saving money, over $1 million a year, what they claimed, was just by reducing wages and benefits. So, you know, the union complained, but there was no real way for them to make any difference. Their only option was to go into a strike, which they really didn't want to do because it's really tough to win a strike of that type. So when the new crews came in, we immediately ran into problems. Things like bathrooms weren't cleaned. Every year the floors get waxed. That was always behind schedule now. Mid-year cleanings of areas, they would miss, you know, if a food fight happened in a cafeteria, there wouldn't be enough time to get everything cleaned that night, so portions would be missed because the contracting company only really gave a set amount of time. There was no way for the principal to say, hey, I need an additional 3 hours to clean up this big mess. And it was just, the schools just kind of became really messy. It was weird because the principals had no power. They couldn't really, they could go out and talk to the contractors, but nothing would ever happen. Nothing would ever change. They'd complain to management. Nothing would ever change. A lot of the principals, a lot of them got fed up. They offloaded the oversight, I guess, to the office manager, who would go out and yell at the workers who are sitting in the break room, not doing anything. And it's just like, you got to go back to work. And that was a big frustration. And this pretty much went on for about 6 years. And the amount of outrage from staff, from parents, from principals, basically across the board said contracting out custodial services doesn't work. And fortunately, the K-12 budget kind of came back, and the school could afford switching back and bringing all those custodials in-house, buying all the new equipment, buying all the supplies, going through the hiring process. And what I found really interesting was that when they went through the hiring process, they rehired a lot of those contractors. And we, at that time, we realized that the hiring procedure was not as rigorous as a school district, and we found many people which were undocumented status and or were disqualified from being able to work in the school district if they went through and hired through the normal process. So there's a lot of icky stuff around contracting, and it's really dangerous because there's not a lot of oversight, there's not a lot of enforcement, and once you're in, you're stuck with it for a long period of time. So I hope that you support this measure. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Devin. Let's hear from our other two panelists, and then we'll take questions.
Thanks, Lori. Mr. Chair. Lori Satinsville for the Oregon School Boards Association here today in opposition to this bill. And with me, Jake Gibbs from Oakland School District and a board member. I just want to talk briefly and then pass it to Jake to talk about the process that they went through with contracting out for busing. Mr. Laffer's presentation was pretty much the same as it was in the 13th session. And I noticed that it looked like it was dated in 04. I wish he talked about longevity and trying to follow some of the districts who have contracted out for a while. And I did have some feedback from districts who have contracted for a while. So maybe some of that is not as fresh as it should be for his presentation, because I did have some information regarding that. Boards go through a lengthy process to arrive at a budget that produces comprehensive education for students to move them along the continuum to 40-40-20. Districts are just beginning to climb back out of the recession. They lost CTE. They lost, they had layoffs, furlough days. They also lost administrators and administration. Contracting out for busing, custodial, food service is some of the typical areas that districts look at for time savings as well as resources, because it's not directly tied to the classroom instruction. As Senator Roblin mentioned in his discussion about the bill, several additional layers to the bill, requiring more upfront information. I think profit and figuring that out with contractors is still a problem to get that information. Central Point was a test case. Initially, the courts have ruled that they follow the process, and it was mentioned already that that case is on appeal. Thank you, Senator Thatcher, for your judicial review question, because that's ours. It's Central Point, the case, it's in court. There's a way to get to the courts for judicial review. I want to dive a little bit deeper into transportation, because that seems to be what's being talked about the most. It's a mandated service. Districts are only reimbursed 70, 80, or 90% of the allowable costs. And one area in busing that's coming down the pike, and Chair Dembro, you asked me about this during the interim, is bus exhaust and DEQ. Districts are having to retrofit school buses, and right now the timeline is you have to have those retrofitted, that they're a 2.7 or 0.7 or newer, done by 2017. ODE has said otherwise you have to replace buses if they're not retrofitted by 2017. There's rules already in place for busing companies who cannot bring, you know, those buses that aren't retrofitted or new into the state. I did ask my business managers out there to comment on this bill related to what they're looking at for retrofitting buses. And as Mr. Laffer also mentioned, districts having budget issues still and budget decisions. These folks have not been able to stay ahead of the need to replace buses in a lot of areas, especially our small and remote and rural. The business managers that we surveyed, one small district came back and said $2 million to replace their buses. So obviously they're going to be looking at contracting out. In previous sessions, we've heard testimony about the use of public funds. We heard it today, misuse, incorrect charges by contractors that put in these charges and the district sends them in for reimbursement. I had a business manager walk me through the process, and I just wanted to take a minute to walk you through that so you understand how that process works, the best I can explain it here. Contractors charge using a variety of methods, frequently use per mile cost. All the costs associated with transportation are put into a 300 object code. Fuel, a 400 object code. Whether the district has their own transportation or contract out for services, they all use the same function code for expenses. In addition, districts, self-operated or contract, have to report mileage data. I think it's been talked about use of buses for other occasions. On an annual basis, identifies the home-to-school miles, non-home-to-school miles, instructional field trips. Using that information, ODE computes the allowable expenses for transportation services and then takes off the unallowable mileage. The statute's very clear on how this is calculated. Special education transportation expenses are usually charged per hour because it takes longer for door-to-door service and movement of wheelchairs in some cases. Business manager told me they don't see how the rules are being followed. It doesn't see a difference because the expenditures are being accounted for in the same way, and how is that a misuse? If the contractor was able to show that their fees, when compared to district costs, including capital outlay, depreciated over a 10-year period, were less, then the district is actually saving public funds and certainly not misusing them. One district in Southern Oregon that's been contracting out since, I believe, 2004. Our costs are well documented based on actual trips with the contractor's help. We closely scrutinize all trips, athletic activity, etc., and closely follow the state law. Our contractor is very much up on what is allowed, and so we have two sets of eyes on expenses. Regarding safety, and I agree, safety is important. the district says we have the same rigor for all others, including drivers, meet the same state regulations as just school districts. He said, I cannot point to a single driver-related incident in my almost 5 years with the district. I'm responsible for signing off the district records, vehicle inspections, just like any other business manager. Furthermore, I'd say our contractor and their counterparts are much more adept at legal compliance because they do it 24/7. In my experience, the sped-specific buses are top-notch, that the staff and the staff that occupy them are first rate.
Lori, we're going to have to speed up. I have another panel.
And I'll pass it to Jake.
Thanks.
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, my name is Jake Gibbs. I am hail from the metropolis of Umpqua, Oregon, which is inside the Oakland School District, and I am a volunteer school board member since 2009 on the Oakland School Board.
Thanks for coming up.
Thank you. Oakland is 500 students, K through 12, all housed in the same campus. We've had all-day kindergarten for the last 3 years. We provide a full suite of extracurricular varsity sports activities. We have maintained and enhanced our band, music, and choir program, elementary through high school, through the last 5 years. We also have had and maintained our shop and welding program at our school, even through all the ups and downs. In 3 years ago, we did go through the process of evaluating the pros and cons, cost benefits of selling or contracting out our transportation services. We've gone through the entire suite of services that the district provides, from business management. As we've had retirements, trying to replace school district business managers is not an easy task today. We've contracted that service with the local ESD, who actually has the expertise and the abilities to provide and manage our business and HR services. We've consolidated our administrative staff. Our superintendent is also our elementary school principal, and when she came on board, became the transportation manager as well. And she quickly realized that we, with her fiscal responsibilities and all the others, realized that we were not going to be able to maintain, or we'd be challenged to maintain the fleet going forward. So we went through the process, and as a board member, I had to go through the formal process of that is required in order to even assess what options were available to us. Were we actually doing the best fiscal decisions for our district? So we negotiated expedited bargaining with our represented staff. They were part of this process all the way through. We wanted to be transparent with our constituents and our employees because they are our employees. The board priorities through all of this was current and future obligations. It isn't the cost of the people is a fixed cost. The replacing buses is not something we can do readily. A priority was the employees. We listened to their concerns, and rightfully so. If change was coming, what would that occur to them? And so we made that a contractual obligation when we negotiated, was that they were kept whole. Standards, safety and mechanical, as Lori indicated, the mechanical requirements of the retrofits and the increased requirements on school safety buses was going to require us to purchase several buses in the next few years. And I'm maybe embarrassed to say this, but the safety training and so forth that that we were currently providing was probably legal, but not where I would prefer it to be. So we went through the process. We had multiple vendors to pick from, and the vendor that we chose, Mid-Columbia, was based on costs, culture, and experience. They've been doing this service for a long time to rural districts and have a long track record with a lot of references for me to verify. Since then, five of the six drivers that were with us at that time are now with Mid-Columbia, and they are unsolicited. They will tell me that they can't get over the improved training that they are getting, the growth opportunities that they have, because now they have the opportunity inside a larger organization to further their careers inside the area. And it's all been positive. So I appreciate the concerns that have been raised, but I would just want to point out for a small district like Oakland and others around the state, this opportunity has been very beneficial, I think, for all parties concerned. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gibbs. So, you know, one of the issues that have been raised has been concern about workers having to take cuts in pay and benefits when they move to the contracting agency. Has that happened for your drivers?
Chair Dembro, that's my knowledge, and that was something we heard loud and clear from the employees when, if this was to go through, that was their major concern, and we made it a contractual obligation with the provider that you would keep these, if these people were hired, met your criteria, you would keep them whole.
Mm-hmm. And so look at, you know, that this bill, one of the things this bill is asking is for an additional step up front, mm-hmm. To make sure that, you know, the companies that bid will meet the, you know, the, those requirements. Would that be a problem for you to add that step? Would that have been a problem for you to add that step?
there were so many steps. Excuse me, Chair Dembro. There were so many steps. I it would have lengthened the 6 to 8 month process, I would assume, that we were already into. And I felt like we did that inherently. So I'm not sure I can answer that in retrospect.
Thanks. Yes, Senator Gelzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that things sound like they've gone there well there. Can you help me understand why in my part of the state, after contracting out for buses, the wages and benefits aren't attractive enough to keep a steady supply of bus drivers? And as I drive around my community, I see signs in fields that say bus drivers needed, no experience necessary, which as a parent,
sure.
Is pretty alarming,
yeah.
Coupled with what I learned when I was on the school board about the failures of safety practices that we had no control over because we had contracted out.
Yeah. Chair Dembro, Senator Gessler, I can't speak for other experiences. I can only attest to ours. The labor pool that I would be exposed to without, regardless of who was providing the service, is the same labor pool. And so I would have concerns. It's going to be a market-driven thing. If we can't pay enough one way or the other, then I'm not going to attract talent to fill that position. Bus driving is an odd, you know, schedule. There's challenges inherent there. So that's about as far as I can go, I think, right now. I'm sorry.
And can I have one more?
Sure.
To Lori, mm-hmm. So you had mentioned that your bus drivers were kept whole with their wages and benefits. Would OSBA be comfortable with a statutory requirement that any organization that was contracting whole must contracting out must keep whole or improve the wages and benefits and keep on board the folks that have been directly employed by the
Chair Dembro, Senator Gelzer, I would love to have a conversation about that, as Roblin had mentioned earlier, to continue to talk about this and come up with a compromise or a solution. I'd be happy to talk about it. I think that inherent that the cost analysis talks about we can't do, you know, salaries and benefit issues, but I've also seen in some of these reports that you're talking about lower wages on one side or the other, and we're not allowed to look in this cost analysis at all the costs. We're told what we can look at. So I'd love to have a continued conversation.
Okay. And I appreciate that. The only reason I asked the question was it seemed like you were offering that in support of this bill to suggest that that's what happens, that
and
all these employees are kept whole with their salary benefits.
And Chair Dembro, that has been mentioned in other cases as well, that is written into the contract.
Quick question.
Well, I just it was brought up that there are some concerns that you brought up, and I'm sorry, I forgot your name, but you were talking about janitorial services and unsatisfactory performance and the frustration that surrounded that. Is there no mechanism in state law that allows for or in when contracts are set up? Maybe you can answer this, where there is a way to terminate a contract for poor performance? It seems like there should be, or
yeah,
ought
Chair
to be,
Dembro,
or is.
Senator Thatcher, mm-hmm. That is correct. The other piece of that, and I've heard a little bit in some food service examples, that if it's a Chartwell's or Sodexo or whoever might have that particular district, it's the business manager or some other person in charge of overseeing that particular service as it's contracted out, and it's that give and take. And yes, we can terminate the contract. We have one district right now looking at bringing in back in food service.
Okay. Senator Belcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Lori, just a question about that, though, going back to transportation out of food service, which I think is a very different thing. How practical is it really for a school district that has contracted out their busing services and sold their fleet to terminate a contract even in the face of egregious safety violations when they then would have no buses and there is no other entity in the area? How would kids get to school?
Chair Dembrough, Senator Gelser, egregious violations. I'm not sure what you're meaning by that. I mean, there's
putting
standards.
Wheelchairs in a bus and not strapping them down.
And I, Chair Dembrough, Senator Gelser, I know things happen on buses, whether it's whether the service provider is a district or it's contracted out. Things happen. Floors don't get done on time, you know.
But I guess the question is, how would the district terminate the contract if they still have to get kids to school? They've contracted out. They've sold all their buses. Doesn't that create a difficulty in that negotiation between the contractor and the school district? It kind of goes to the question mm-hmm. that Senator Thatcher asked. Do they really have that opportunity to cancel
Chair Dembrough,
cancel
Senator
contract?
Gelser, renewal time, they can look at other options. Yes, there's always options.
Okay, why don't we end it at that? Thank you for those questions. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Gibbs, thank you very much for coming up here, and you too, Devin. we have another panel that I think is made up of opponents to education. No, that's a joke. local government people. But we really don't have much time. I wonder, certainly we can reopen the public hearing in the future on this. Is there anybody who had to travel here to get here? You're Mr. Smith? Yeah, could you come forward then and share your expertise with us, please? Thank you.
I appreciate the opportunity. Good afternoon, Chair Dembrough and committee members. My name is Brian Smith, and I'm the purchasing manager for Multnomah County, and I'm going to vary a little bit here from my prepared notes, but one of the things you've heard here are a lot of stories about neglecting really the contract administration function, which is a very separate issue in public purchasing from the original procurement issue. And it just occurred to me one of the things that is missing that might be helpful to include in a bill like this would be to actually require a contract administration plan prior to actually contracting out. This is also a solution that previously on construction manager general contractor legislation that's been done in the previous sessions included subcontracting plan to deal with issues that we know are going to happen later on, but that are really important to these public decisions. So. I was part of the 2009 House Bill 2867 group that Senator Roblin spoke about in terms of coming up with a compromise for a bill that actually would be palatable. And since then, I've spent the last 5 years implementing these measures. And the original text of that particular law came from statutes that had been passed in both Michigan and California that had no one was quite sure or could speak to how they had been implemented in the past. And their intent was just try it out and see how it works. So I've been implementing this over the last 5 years, and it's been my experience at Multnomah County, where we do food service. Certainly we don't do transportation, but we do a whole variety of goods and services that we purchase. And we've done 50 of these in terms of the $250,000 threshold over the last 5 years. And it takes an average of about 3 hours to do each one in terms of the paperwork, both a review and approval. And it really, from a practical point of view, it becomes a lot of paperwork. I'd call it classic red tape, but that's the particular law. The bill that's before you right now, there are four items that I find that are particularly problematic, and I'd like to address those. First, estimating the profit of the potential contractor will realize depends on so many factors outside the control of the contracting agency. And this is the contractor size, their debt load, employee productivity, that really the estimate in that really is no better than guessing. The it was asserted previously that it was currently illegal to ask for information from vendors with an RFI process. We do RFI processes already. They're not formal procurement processes, but they're information gathering, and agencies can do them today. So conducting the RFI and the RFQ does nothing to change the underlying fact that the profit potential is simply a guess. And particularly in markets like transportation, where you've had a number of people say that there are three firms that provide this service statewide, those firms are not going to give you their profit margin. Because once they give me their profit margin, that's a public record. And there's absolutely no way when I go to ask a vendor pool, what's your profit margin, that they're actually going to tell me. And to suggest otherwise, it's ridiculous. So second, the bill prevents excluding proceeds or revenue from sale or long-term capital of other assets in the cost analysis. And this is really a one-sided provision in that it precludes the contracting agency from determining the highest and best use of its assets and using that information in the decision to move forward with a procurement or not. Third, I think that the provision for judicial review, which is included in this bill, would actually increase the likelihood that critical projects would experience delay due to litigation. Fourth, I think the bill prevents the court from awarding attorney fees and court costs to the prevailing party, and I think this removes any disincentive to filing frivolous charges. So all of these provisions were features of the original legislation that was introduced in 2009. They were all negotiated out, and since then, and this is now the third session that I've been here, where they're trying to come back in. It's not been my experience that indiscriminate outsourcing of public services is a large problem. I think the feasibility and cost analysis requirements currently in statute have added additional bureaucracy and made our public procurement processes less efficient at a time when we're doing our best to provide greater efficiencies to taxpayers. So I'll stop there and thank you once again for your time, and I'd love to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Ms. Smith, appreciate your testimony very much. Any quick questions? Okay.
Well, I guess just for one quick, I was kind of thinking along that line that there needs to be some sort of process on the basics of what's in a contract, an administration, and a plan, and not necessarily prescribe all the details, but just there needs to be an outline. Maybe there is. But
there isn't.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good suggestion. Okay, colleagues, and broad audience, we will probably reschedule a hearing on this in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, I would be very open to some conversations with stakeholders to see where we're going with this. Okay?
Thank you very much again,
Ms. Smith. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 414. Colleagues, anything for the good of the order? Seeing none, we are adjourned.